New Year's. I just, you know, it continues to blow my mind that it's already another year. It continues to blow my mind that I've got a birthday coming up at the end of this month, and I don't really want to count anymore. It's just amazing how fast the time is going. And at the same time, you know, I think about it, and these lines that we draw in the calendar are just artificial lines, aren't they? I mean, they really don't mean anything. The earth is turning, it's spinning, it's doing its thing, it's measuring out the span in circles, but the circles just begin where they ended and end where they began, and it's we humans that like to stretch that out and draw lines and make all of these milestones along the way, and it's natural for us to do so, it's necessary for us to do so. But I was thinking about when Marion and I were first married. We were renting an apartment in Irvine in an area called Turtle Rock, which was right on the edge of a nature preserve. And among all the critters that you could see there, from rattlesnakes to quail to bobcats to the occasional mountain lion, there was a colony of turkey vultures that roosted in the tops of the stands of towering eucalyptus trees that were all around us. And I used to love these birds. They were so much fun to watch. A lot of the other people didn't, and they were lobbying to get them out of there because you can imagine what the sidewalks look like. Not only with the guano, but the pellets, you know, they regurgitate the parts they can't digest and all this stuff. But I just loved having these birds around. I'd get up in the morning to go to work, and there they would be, you know, starting to ruffle and shift and move, waiting for the thermals to come, and then they would take off and ride those thermals up to really terrific heights. And then in the evening when I come home, they'd all be coming back. They went to the office just like I did. It was amazing to watch them. But as I was thinking about them, I was thinking, I don't know what day it is. They got up on Saturday and Sunday the same way they did on Monday and Tuesday. It made no difference to them. Day in, day out, year out. The only thing they cared about was when it rained. There's never anything so miserable looking as a turkey vulture on a rainy day, just sitting up there hunkered down, you know, just trying to wait it out. No thermals on a rainy day. They don't know about days of the week. They don't know about years. They know light, they know dark, and they know rain. And that's about it. And that's the way it's been for 100,000 years, 200, half a million, who knows how long. These birds have been flying. There are no lines. It's just one continuous stretch of day and night and time. And that really is our reality. It really is the way time works. But we as humans need these lines. We need to subdivide. We need to categorize. We need to have predictable things that we can look forward to, places that we can go and times that we can meet. And all the interaction that we have as humans depends upon our calendar. And so that's not a bad thing. But it's important to realize that these lines are artificial. They're just drawn on. They're not real. But they can mean something to us, and they can become real to us. And we can use these lines, as we just prayed, to mark a time of regeneration, to mark a time of rebirth, to mark a time of resolution. How many of you have New Year's resolutions this year? Anybody still trying to do that? Okay, we got a few. All right, good. You know, okay, good. The gyms, the workout gyms, are counting on you people, of course, to have your resolution, because they know they'll be able to rebook your space in a few months. Not this time, not this time. And so we use these times. We use this stuff. So when you think about it, this year is complete. This year has been perfected. In the sense of the Aramaic word that we were using a couple weeks ago of gemar, which means completion or perfection. But nobody would say this last year was perfect, would you? But it was complete and perfected last night at midnight. It was done. It was fulfilled. The fullness of its cycle was completed. And that is a sense in which we are perfected. It's a sense in which this time was perfected. We have been perfected. We have endured through 2011. You know? That's not to say that we did a good job necessarily, or we did a great job, or anywhere in between, had our good days and bad days. But the sense of that word, the sense of what James is trying to tell us, is that it has come to fruition. It has come to fullness. In the last few weeks, we started a series on James. So those of you who are here for the first time, we're going through the book of James. This will be the third message in that, and we're still not out of the first half of the first chapter. That's the way we go around here, you know, dig deep. And so we're talking about this theme of endurance. In this first chapter, James is focusing on endurance. Count it all joy when you arrive at these trials and tribulations, because when you endure, the endurance creates these desired effects in your life. And we talked about that. In fact, let's just read a little bit of that. James 1, 2 to 4. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, and let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And then at verse 12, blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Consider it all joy. We talked about that. You'd have to be crazy to consider it joy when some of these things hit you. We're not talking about just missing a parking space. We're talking about the really difficult things in life. Everything to a life-threatening illness, to the loss of a loved one, these difficult things, he's saying, count it all joy. What is going on here? What we talked about was that he is trying to get us to accept life on its own terms, to accept life as it is. We read the passage from Scott Peck 3 weeks ago. Life is difficult, the first sentence of that book. Life is difficult. But at the moment that you accept life's difficulty, it ceases to be difficult anymore. When we can accept what is, when we stop resisting it, when we actually make friends with it, shake hands, introduce yourself, make friends with life as it is, it ceases to be so difficult. We aren't expecting it to be something other than it is. We aren't feeling victimized and martyred when things don't go our way anymore, because we know that all these trials and all these tribulations that hit us are what are common to everybody who's on this planet and who has ever been on this planet. It's the way life is, and it's that way for a reason. Don't just grin and bear it. We're not talking about endurance with gritted teeth. That's not the kind of endurance that James is talking about. We have a name for that. It's called the dry drunk, most miserable person on the planet. It's not just gritting through the difficulties. It's actually seeing that through them, you will get your perfect result. Someone this morning was just asking me, how do I find wisdom? I said, well, the first thing is you're not going to get it out of a book, and you're not going to get it out of a conversation. And you're not just going to get it out of the things in your life that you do correctly. You can get wisdom from the things that you do incorrectly, the mistakes you make, the places that you fall down, as much as those things that you do well. As long as you endure through them, as long as you get to the other side. This is what James is trying to tell us. These difficulties truly are our friends in disguise. If we will persevere, if we will endure, the wisdom, the clarity, the understanding, the compassion, the empathy, the creativity that can come from all of these things is incalculable. And it's unavailable any other way. This is the point. How else are you going to get these things unless you live through them? You can't. And blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. That blessed there, just like in the Beatitudes, tobe in Aramaic, it is a form of the word taba, which means good. And it can mean enriched. It can mean fortunate are. It can mean congratulations too. It can mean wholeness and richness and everything else. That is the person who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised. And of course, we have images of God taking note, you know, keeping a tally of all the good things that we do, all the times that we endure, so that he can reward us later. And we miss the point that all of this is simultaneous. The approval is the same word as the testing or the trial itself. It is in the endurance, it is in the moving through that we are approved. Just like fishing line. Whatever pound test it is, it's not something that is bestowed or granted. It is something that is realized in the trial, in the enduring, in the perseverance. These things are so important for us to understand. The book of James is kind of interesting when you read it. Many scholars have commented on the fact that the topics all seem to bounce around. And he starts with one topic, goes to another, comes back later on. I wanted to finish off this theme of endurance this morning. We got to go all the way to chapter 5 in order to do it, to find the last couple of verses that deal with endurance in James. And I want to jump there right now so that we can kind of put a cap on this and we can start to understand what it is that we're talking about here. This idea of grateful endurance. James 5, 10 to 11. As an example, brethren, James 5, 7 to 8. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. The farmer who waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it until it gets the early and late rains. You too be patient. Strengthen your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is near. Therefore, be patient. And the word there in the Greek can mean patiently endure. Patiently endure. And so, in addition now to this notion of endurance as being joyful, as being grateful, as realizing that these difficulties are our friends, now we have another image to add on to that. It's the image of patience. It's the image of long-suffering. This idea that there is a time frame to this whole thing. There is a cycle to this whole thing. And this coming of the Lord is a difficult one for us because we all automatically, when we think of the coming of the Lord, we're thinking of the second coming of the Lord. We're thinking of sometime in the far off future or maybe tomorrow. Who knows that the Lord is going to come back. But in the idiom of the day, the coming of the Lord could simply mean your own death. Or in the idiom of the day, it could mean the destruction of Jerusalem that many were looking forward to, or some were looking forward to at that time, and which only occurred about, 8 or 9 years after this letter was written, something like that. Or it could look forward to the coming of the Lord. Doesn't really matter because the idea is the same in all cases. The idea is you patiently endure. You are patient. You are moving with the cycles until the trials are removed. In whatever way that they're removed, either by your own death, by the end of history as you know it, by the second coming, the idea is the same. And then this idea that the coming of the Lord is near. Well, in the first century, many of the followers of Jesus expected him to come back in their own lifetime. The way that he expressed these things made them feel that he was coming back before they died. But there's another idea to this as well. And it goes back to the Jewish wedding tradition. When the bride is waiting for the groom to come back, she doesn't know the day or the hour that he's coming, but is supposed to stay in perpetual readiness. And so this idea that you were supposed to be ready for whenever this event occurred, whether it is your own death, or whether it is the coming of the bridegroom, or whether it is the coming of a sacking army, you were to be ready. You were to live your life as if the next moment would be the end of your trials. And that readiness, that attitude, carries the excitement, carries the joy and the anticipation, but also sustains the patience and the long-suffering. Literally, if you don't know when the Lord is coming, then he's always coming shortly. Isn't he? If it could be any day, any hour, then why not this day, this hour? It could be. And knowing that that is so imminent, could be so imminent, is where the excitement comes from. If we could live our life with that kind of buzz, with that kind of anticipation, what would that change your days? What would they look like? What would you do differently? How would you react? Yeah, you still got to go to work every day. Maybe it's not your favorite thing to do. Bad day fishing is better than a good day at work, right? But at work, how would you be different? At all the things that you did, if right through that door, right around that corner, was the end of all your trials. This is the notion here of patience. This is the notion that James is trying to get across. This was embedded deep in the Hebrew psyche. And the understanding of how they lived and how their brides and bridegrooms interacted with each other. But it's something that we miss often, this idea that we are always supposed to be ready. always supposed to be anticipating the Lord's return. And then he gives us this beautiful, beautiful image. The image of the farmer. The farmer waits for the precious produce of the soil, being patient about it, until it gets the early and late rains. You know what the early and late rains were in Palestine? Especially in the first century. There were two rainy seasons in Judea, in that area of the eastern Mediterranean. And the rains started in the winter, and they started again in the spring. And those were the only two times during the year that you could count on rains. And so they started in late October, and they would run through November, maybe early December. And then they'd start again in mid-late March and run again through the end of April. And if you didn't get your planting done, if you weren't prepared for those rains, there wasn't going to be any rain from April until October again. And you would parch during that summer. And so the planting seasons were fixed to these times of the rains. They were fixed to the times of the seasons. The ancients were very aware of the turning of the celestial bodies, of the cardinal points of the compass, and the cardinal points of the celestial zodiac that helped them to gauge when these times were coming, time to plant, their calendar, their festivals, all geared to these important times of the agrarian cycle. And so these early and late rains, they became set points. They became touchstones within the year. And the people knew we needed to have our planting here. We need to be able to work through that rainy season. And we need to be ready for the spring and the rains that will take us through to the harvest. They had to know these things. And they weren't under their control. They had to wait for them to come. Remember the image of the conveyor belt that we talked about a while back? You know, I Love Lucy in our minds. You know, the candy's coming down the conveyor belt. You got to wait for it. You do your thing with it and you let it go. And you have to wait for the next one. If you get ahead of yourself, if you get behind yourself, if you're not right here, now, present to what's right in front of you, you will lose the whole cycle and the whole business. This is what it's like when you are tied to the earth, when you are tied to the ground. And it teaches you something about the way that we're supposed to live our lives. Think about our church now. What's the primary metaphor that we tend to use for our spiritual lives in the church today? I'll tell you, it's usually the warrior, isn't it? We think about going to battle. We talk about going to battle for Christ. We use Paul's description of putting on the armor of God, girding ourselves for battle and going out. We talk about taking the land for Christ. We organize our churches in imperialistic and hierarchical ways that mirror military hierarchy, or at least political hierarchy. You know, we've got the pyramidal structure. We talk about sending armies out onto the streets to evangelize. It's this very imperialistic, very kind of penetrative act that we go out there and I need to fight for and win hearts and lives for the Lord. For their own good, of course, you know. But if they don't agree with us, we've got to fight until they do, right? I mean, that's the mindset that we've got. And then we talk about our battles and the attacks of the enemy. In fact, one of the ways that we give ourselves a pat on the back, obviously, is to say that we know we must be doing something good if the enemy's attacking us. Because now he's taken notice of my prowess on the battlefield. He wouldn't attack me if I wasn't a front runner, right? Just like all these presidential candidates right now. They only get attacked when they achieve front runner status. But here we are, warriors, warriors. And think of the life of the warrior. What does that look like? Always girded for battle. Always looking around and over your shoulder for the enemy. Always looking from where the next attack will come. Always looking to see how you can take advantage, to maneuver, to strategize. Always looking to take, whether it's land or whether it's people. But that mindset is something that Jesus never expressed. He never used that imagery. The imagery is in the Bible, both Old and New Testament, but Jesus doesn't use it. The image that Jesus uses over and over again consistently is the farmer and the gardener. And there's a really good reason for that. Because his way doesn't look like the military. It looks like the farmer. It looks like this. It is a constant and patient waiting for the unfolding of things. It is a moving in harmony with the seasons, with the wind, with the flow of nature. It's not moving against it. It's not a strident opposition. It's not a going out and grabbing things by the throat. It's a tending and a planting and a nurturing. It's a taking time with your feet deep in the soil and squinting into the sun to find hints of coming weather. It's watching which way the wind is blowing, which way the birds are moving, so that you know what you're supposed to be doing in this vast moving tapestry. There's a book that's been influential for me, and I wanted to read just a couple of paragraphs from it to try to give you an idea of what this looks like. This was written by a native Middle Eastern who speaks the native languages, Arabic, Aramaic, Hebrew, and he has a decidedly Eastern take on things. But just listen to what he writes in this short section called Waiting for Completeness, which is what we're talking about here, this endurance that takes us to completion. What is that endurance supposed to look like? He writes, if we accept this completeness as a goal for our life's work, the questions arise. How and when do we get there? What do we do with our incompleteness in the meantime? To answer these questions, we need to consider the Aramaic sense of two words considered briefly in our introduction, good and evil. These words have more non-Middle Eastern baggage attached to them than any others we have considered so far. To begin to unload this baggage, imagine the following scene with me. The smell of apple, almond, and sycamore trees in blossom. The sight of riotously colored wildflowers in bloom on a hillside above the Sea of Galilee. The sound of thousands of variegated water birds, egrets, herons, and cranes, following their intricate and beautiful migratory patterns up the Jordan Rift River Valley, just at the right time. The black basalt hills above the Sea of Galilee providing rich, dark, but very thin soil upon which to sow. The strong winds blowing in from the Mediterranean at particular times of the day. In such a setting, timing was essential for success in planting. In Yeshua's day, the whole area of Galilee was much wetter than it is now, virtually a jungle in many areas. Water buffalo and lion roamed about. To travel safely through this wild landscape depended on knowing when certain areas were flooded, when animals that might be dangerous to humans were present, and when and where one could find edible food. Yeshua experienced all of these sensations of the natural world around him as it followed the rhythm of sacred unity. To describe this rhythm of rightness and ripeness, the Aramaic language uses the word taba, usually translated good. From its roots, the word points to something that maintains its integrity and health. That would be the ti or the tav. By an inner sense of growth and harmony with what surrounds it. That would be the bi or the bet. The Gospels quote Jesus using the word taba in several different ways. In one sense, it means that which is in tune, in time, and in harmony with sacred unity. Those who are good are at the right place, at the right time, with the right action. In this sense, they are prepared for any event, ready, with full presence in the moment. What is that sounding like? Just what we talked about. The bride waiting for her bridegroom. All of us waiting for the coming of the Lord. Full presence in the moment, at the right place, at the right time. Taba, ripeness, goodness, in harmony, flowing with. All of these things captured in this word. And a derivative of this word means to prepare or to make ready, as in Luke 3:4, where John the Baptist quotes Isaiah, "Prepare ye the way of the Lord." In the same sense, one can also make oneself ready for Passover. As we saw previously, transforming the soul self asks for an ever more refined sense of timing and readiness. Everything does not happen at once. Everything doesn't happen at once. The warrior tries to make it so, tries to turn things into an event, but it's a process. Everything doesn't happen at once. By contrast, that which is bisha in Aramaic, usually translated evil, has fallen out of rhythm with sacred unity. This may mean that the being or act in question has been delayed in its progress and is not yet ready for the purpose for which it is meant. Or it may mean that the being or act is no longer ripe. At one time and place it was appropriate, but now it has departed from the rhythm of the sacred I am and has become rotten, so to speak. On the inner level, these qualities of unripeness can apply to the images of the self held by the nafsha, which would be the Hebrew word for soul or self, and the way that different voices within the subconscious present themselves to the conscious mind. I love that characterization of the realities of the cycles of life. The farmer, the gardener, has to wait for things to unfold. You can't force it. You plant the seeds. You water the seeds. You have prepared the soil before all that takes place. And then what? You're going to pull that shoot out of the ground? There is nothing you can do but wait. Wait. That's why I can't stand gardening. I got to wait. But what has been Yeshua trying to get through my thick skull for the last 20 years is that this is the only way that things work in the spiritual world. You want to get wisdom? You need to wait. You need to simply live your life. You need to go through the difficult things that are going to show you the parts of your character that are strong and the parts that are not. The things that you can do well and the things that still need work. The process of life is that which teaches, and there are no shortcuts. There is no way to circumvent this process. No way to quickly go from point A to point B. Because as soon as you do that, you have self-defeated the entire process. It's not getting to the destination, as you've heard a million times, that is the goal of our spiritual journeys. It is the unfolding of the process of our journey itself that teaches us everything that we need to learn if we are willing, if, as Jesus says, we have new ears to hear. We have to change our thinking. We as Westerners, as modern people, are so goal-oriented. We are so focused. We are so military, such warriors. We need to go and take the land. Jesus says, no, just go find a place to stand and the land will take you. It will become you. You will become it. You will become one. And in that oneness, you will learn something that there is no other way to learn. It's a completely different mindset. A completely different way of looking at life. And it's so hard for us. We don't farm. We don't stand with our feet in the soil anymore. How long has it been since any of you have had your toes in the dirt? We walk around on rubber soles, electrically isolated from the ground. That's the way we live. We move from one air-conditioned enclosure to another. We don't feel the rhythms of nature the way the ancients did. But we can make it our business to learn to do just that. And maybe it'll be more difficult because we can't look up at night and see a billion stars the way they could and be reminded of the awe and the glory of the Almighty. But in our mind's eye, we can go there. In our spiritual heart, we can go there if that's what we purpose to do. Jesus makes this point so strongly here in John 10. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter by the door into the fold of the sheep, but climbs up some other way, he is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is a shepherd of the sheep. To him the doorkeeper opens, and the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them. And at verse 7, so Jesus said to them again, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not hear them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved, and he will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and to kill and to destroy. I came that they may have life and life abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. I know some of you have heard my rendition of the first century sheep enclosure, but it's important to understand that in the first century, shepherds would make ad hoc enclosures. They would just make it out of whatever they could find, sticks and rocks, and they would usually back it up to the side of a hill or a cliff, and they would build out three sides of the enclosure. Didn't have to go very high. Sheep aren't particularly bright, and so they'll stay inside if they see something holding them in. There was a space on one of the sides that was the door. And sometimes a shepherd would actually take the pains to fashion some sort of gate, but most often, just leave it open and lay down and sleep there in that opening. And the sheep would not step over him. The sheep would stay put. They would see him as the door. To understand that physical reality of their lives is to start to understand what Jesus is talking about. He is the door. He is the shepherd who is laying down in that opening. Anybody who comes by that way is legitimate. Everybody who comes by that way has gone through the process that Jesus is talking about. He is the way and the truth and the life. And no one comes to the Father but through him. This way of living life, this way of being present to the moment, this way of patiently waiting for things to unfold, to find the connection with each other, the oneness and the unity, not only with each other as human beings, but with nature as a whole, to find our place in it, to experience our God's goodness, and know that we know that it's real, and know that we know our relationship with him is the way that Jesus is talking about. Anybody who climbs over another way and short circuits the system is not of the sheepfold, is a thief and a robber and has some other agenda. There is no way to shortcut this process. Jesus is the way. To go by that door, to go through that way, is to endure and persevere through the trials and the tribulations that life hands us. And to learn something through that process, something precious, something not obtainable any other way. At John 10:14, he says again, "I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me." I am the good shepherd. You know that translates in Aramaic? Probably not. It translates Ena Ena Raya Taba. Ena Ena Raya Taba. And literally that would translate in English, I, shepherd good. I, shepherd good. We've talked about this before, that Ena Ena, that double singular personal pronoun, is an intensive form in Aramaic and in Hebrew. I is an intensive form of I am. It's usually translated I am. But it can also refer to simple presence itself. When Moses asked the name of the God who was speaking to him from the burning bush that was sending him to back to Egypt, you know, it was Haya Asher Haya. I am that I am. I am who I am. God replies with the only way that he can talk about himself, which is pure being, pure presence. Ena, Ena is alluding to the same thing. It's pure being, pure presence. The way that you could translate this, I am the good shepherd, would be, my presence is the shepherd of ripeness. Good shepherd, taba, ripeness, unity, harmony. My presence is the shepherd of harmony. My presence is the shepherd of unity, ripeness, in timeness, flow. And we can extend that even further to say, simple presence, pure presence, is the shepherd of this ripeness. We are shepherding ripeness. We are tending to ripeness as Jesus did. When we practice our presence with each other, our presence with the moment, and our presence with God. Practicing presence is tending to completion, tending to perfection, gamar, in the way that we talked about it. Not that we never make a mistake, don't misunderstand, but that we can be ready when the time comes. For what? For the coming of the Lord? For the coming of my 7-year-old son, for the coming of Sunday morning, for the coming of anything in your life. You are ready. You are ripe. You are in the right place at the right time when you are present, when you are there, when you can truly see who is with you and what the needs are. And you can make the choices based on that so that you can always leave a moment leaving the people in them better than they found you and better than you found them. I am the good shepherd. My presence is the shepherd of this ripeness, completion, and perseverance. This year has come to an end and a new one is starting. We have endured through one cycle and we are starting another cycle. There are cycles within cycles. All these processes within processes. We need to stop seeing the beginning and end of things, and we need to live the middle of things richly and completely with full presence. This new year that we have high hopes for, the hopes will be realized when our presence is realized. Regardless of what happens in the economy, regardless what happens in the world system, in the presidential elections, at your job, anything else, your presence will dictate the experience of your life. And this is what Jesus, this is what James is trying to show us. Endure, persevere, not with gritted teeth, but see that the process itself is your friend and your teacher and the way to the Father with Jesus at our side. Let's pray. Father, we're grateful for another year that we get to spend on this planet, for the year that we have spent on this planet. We ask that you would draw us closer and closer, or better stated, that you would allow us to be drawn closer as you draw us. Help us to relax. Help us to see your hand in everything. Help us to see how this life is engineered in such a way that we have everything that we need to do everything that we're supposed to do in you. Help us to grasp on, fall into your embrace, to understand how cared for we are, how loved we are, so that we can risk the things we think we need to risk in order to make new choices and go in new directions. Father, thank you for a new year. Thank you for your love. We love you because you first loved us. In Jesus' name, amen. Let's all stand.